Chapter 33. Persecution Intensified. The Christian Scientist knows that spiritual faith and understanding pass through the waters of Meribah, here. Bitter waters, but he also knows they embark for infinity and anchor in omnipotence. Mary Baker Eddy, 1899. Christian scientists were healing all manner of disease among the people, including countless cases that had been pronounced incurable or terminal by attending physicians. Some physicians who witnessed such results sought the explanation in science and health, and not a few forsook materia medica for the practice of Christian science. However, many more were alarmed at this challenge to their livelihood and status, and in many states sought the passage of medical bills which would make the practice of Christian science illegal. Scientists had been and continued to be arrested for their humanitarian efforts, and though eventually acquitted, there was a good deal of persecution and prosecution in the 1890s. Much of this roused fair-minded, public-spirited citizens to the defense of the persecuted, and more than one newspaper remarked that proposed legislation would forbid Jesus Christ from healing were he present in their state. But a much more insidious attack, aimed mainly at Mrs. Eddy, had continued for several years and became greatly intensified in 1899. Numerous derogatory news items, letters, and poems, which could all be classified as character assassination, appeared in papers in various locations. And the leader was not surprised when students traced their authorship to Josephine Woodbury. George Moses, the very able young editor of the Concord Monitor and of the Independent Statesman, although not a Christian scientist, was favorably disposed toward the founder and her cause. When the derisive campaign began in earnest, early in 1899, he wrote Mrs. Eddy that Mrs. Woodbury had been presenting such items to him for several years, though he had declined to publish any, including numerous anonymous letters of like kind, which he attributed to the same source. Edward Ahrens and Julius Dresser had both passed away since their vilification of God's chosen witness in their unsuccessful attempts to label her a fraud and attribute her discovery of Christian science to Quimby. The leader knew that this old lie was being reactivated, so she had the facts of the Quimby contention, including letters and documentation, republished in the Christian Science Sentinel of February 16th. She also established a publishing committee, since renamed Committee on Publication, to refute false charges, prepare factual corrections, and see to their publication and circulation. As a member of the publishing committee, Judge Hanna prepared and published a pamphlet entitled Christian Science History, which was freely distributed to newspapers and clergymen. Editors across the land received a copy of Hannah's pamphlet with an accompanying note from the Publishing Society, which read, "In order that you may have on file some of the facts in connection with the history and initiation of the Christian Science movement, we are sending you a copy of a late pamphlet entitled Christian Science History. We believe there is always a desire on the part of editors to establish what is true and are glad to afford the means for presenting the truth regarding a movement which is establishing goodwill among men and regarding the leader thereof. But all this was an undercurrent of the progress of the cause as seen by many students. What they saw was the erection and dedication of more and more churches, the popularity of the lectures, and most important of all, the wonderful healing which was going on everywhere. Mrs. Eddy sent a letter she received from Mrs. Daniel G. Saunders in Kansas City, Missouri, to Christian Science Hall to be read at the Wednesday evening meeting on March 1st. Thinking that it would be of some pleasure to you to know of some few things which I have been able to demonstrate over from studying the blessed book, Science and Health, which you have so lovingly given to the world, I want to tell you of one demonstration of love, which will be no new thing to you, I know, but which I felt it would be a pleasure for you to know. My cousin, who lives here in the city, had a little baby who was, quote, to belief, end quote, in pneumonia. I had not been informed of this until one afternoon they came in great haste for me, saying that the baby was dying and for me to come immediately. I went, and soon after I reached the house, the baby passed on. All of the relatives were there, one physician who was a brother to the mother of the babe, and my first cousin. Also a trained nurse and other physicians were in attendance. I was not called to demonstrate, but only as a relative. The thought of life came to me with such power as I had never realized before. I could not keep from declaring that God is life, and that life never died, and that this babe had not died, for it reflected life and could not die. I had no intention of treating the baby, only making the sense of death unreal to myself. Next, I found myself standing over the cradle where the baby had been laid. The eyes had been closed by the nurse, the limbs straightened, the water was being made ready to bathe the babe, the clothes had been brought, etc., etc. All had ceased their weeping and said all was done. When I reached the cradle, I saw the babe breathe. Then the little eyes opened and were clear and bright as could be, which before had been, as they said, covered with a death glimmer for 2 days. My cousin, the doctor, came and kneeled on the other side of the cradle, and he took the baby's hand, felt the pulse, and exclaimed, quote, "Cousin Sally, this baby has pulse," end quote. I kept holding to the truth of being. Then I said to the mother of the babe, "May I take baby up?" She answered, "Yes." I took the baby and walked to the register, thinking I would warm his feet. But to my astonishment, his hands and feet were warm. Then I asked the mother if I could treat the babe, and she replied, "I wish you would." They knew of Christian Science, but had never accepted it. When I was through treating the child, my cousin, the doctor, who was kneeling in front of me and who was still holding the baby's little hand, looked up into my face and asked, "Cousin Sally, what did you do to this little baby to bring it back to life?" My reply was, "Willie, I realized that life is God, and that baby reflected life, and I knew that life never died." He replied that he had been trying to do that all day and said, "I have been praying, for I knew that my medicine would never heal the little one." The nurse and all the relatives witnessed this, and it being so impersonal, it made us all feel more humble. I think, too, that I never had more gratitude for you, Mother, than in this instance. It gave me a faint glimpse of what you are to us, a wayshower. My prayer daily is to be more spiritual, that I may do more as you would have me do, and my heart overflows with gratitude for science and health, with key to the scriptures, for miscellaneous writings, and all the words you have given us, and may we all love you more. And as you have said, so live it, that the world may know that the Christ is come. Another item that interested the field had been the announcement in the November journal of a new portrait of Mrs. Eddy that was for sale, which was now superseded by a notice in the Sentinel, dated March 27th, and signed by Mrs. Eddy. It is with pleasure I certify that after months of incessant toil and at great expense, Mr. Henry P. Moore and Mr. J.C. Derby of Concord, New Hampshire, have brought out a likeness of me far superior to the one they offered for sale last November. The portrait they have now perfected, I cordially endorse. Also, I declare their sole right to the making and exclusive sale of the duplicate of said portrait. I simply ask that those who love me purchase this portrait. Perhaps a news item reprinted in another March Sentinel caused the leader to think of her own beloved Christian Scientists. The news item stated that the Inspector General had completed his list of the Cuban Army and estimated the total number to be 50,000, quote, of which 25,000 are officers or officials holding commissions and entitled to officers' pay, end quote. In February, Mrs. Eddy had written the directors, thanking them for their committee on help for Pleasant View. But early in March, she declined the help of the one they named as superintendent. Though her letter was very graciously worded, the meaning, if stated bluntly, was that Pleasant View did not need a superintendent, but a gardener and a florist. According to members of her household, Mrs. Eddy always superintended her home and her real estate, even including such minor details as to which flowers were to be planted in different locations. Local affairs, too, received the leader's attention. Many towns in America had very poor roads in 1899, but Mrs. Eddy proposed that something be done about the situation in her town, petitioning the mayor of Concord to that effect in March and following this petition with a plan and a sizable donation. But with all her varied and admirable activities, the unjust and slanderous attacks continued. Having her address to the Concord Church spread broadcast may have been for the purpose of counteracting these attacks, but it did not stop them. As the Christian Science movement gained momentum, it was almost as if the imp of darkness was trotting right alongside. No doubt, Hannah's Christian Science history did much good. A letter therein to Hannah from Mrs. Eddy explains how she knew the lie about Quimby was being reactivated, and by whom. I possess a spiritual sense of what the malicious mental malpractitioner is mentally arguing, which cannot be deceived. I can discern in the human mind thoughts, motives, and purpose, and neither mental arguments nor psychic power can affect this spiritual insight. It is as impossible to prevent this native perception as to open the door of a room and then prevent a man who is not blind from looking into the room and seeing all it contains. This mind reading is first sight. It is the gift of God, and this phenomena appeared in my childhood. It is associated with my earliest memories and has increased with years. It has enabled me to heal in a marvelous manner, to be just in judgment, to learn the divine mind, and it cannot be abused. No evil can be done by reason of it. If the human mind communicates with me in sleep, when I awake, this communication is as palpable as words audibly spoken. The leader had early communicated with Edward A. Kimball regarding the malicious mental malpractice. For in his lecture of March 1st in Chicago, Kimball refuted several falsehoods, including the Quimby claim. In a letter of March 20th to Augusta Stetson, the leader wrote, "As to W, take no notice of what is nothing. Would you fear or advertise a plague of cholera or whatever physical evil? No, indeed. Then treat all as mortal nothingness that seems to be a plague. Be wise as the serpent that she is, and thus bruise the head that bites your heel." Very possibly, Mrs. Woodbury had called on Mrs. Stetson, for later when she called and was refused admittance, the mother's telegram in answer to Augustus's call of alarm said, quote, "Fear nothing, child. Electricity cannot convey poison through nerve centers," end quote. In 1898, Alfred Farlow had been appointed to the lecture board, but by March of 99, Mrs. Eddy had brought him to Boston, probably to head the publishing committee for meeting the public attacks upon Christian Science and its founder. Malicious mental malpractice was almost beyond the comprehension of the students of that day, and the demands for meeting such wickedness almost beyond their ability. So, as usual, all the work fell upon the leader's shoulders, and as had been the case with Augusta Stetson, she had to help them more than they helped her. The situation is depicted in a letter of March 30th to Reverend Tomlinson. "My beloved student, I had not time to write you. I am trying to attend to my book, but do not get over 1 hour in the day to read proof. I should have said, have Mr. Farlow read the letter to you." This was in substance its contents to Board of Directors and Publishing Committee. "Do your duty mentally for the press. Break the spell of W on it. Defend the constitutional rights of ours. See if you cannot do as much good as others evil." The first plan included to work mentally. If this has been carried out, are the best and leading scientists showing by their works they are unequal to so small a task mentally? And if it has been neglected, why is it? More mental work for the field must be done. With love always, Mother, M. B. Eddy. Note well. The letter I sent to Mr. F. was not addressed to you and did not include you. He is a gem of character. So is the judge. But they are not watching with me in this crucial hour. I am as usual, alone. Again, Mother. Perhaps Julia Bartlett knew more than anyone, other than Mrs. Eddy, of the evil that seemed to be using Josephine Woodbury. It was nothing new. Though Mrs. Woodbury always upheld her lies and her actions, there was one day in 1895 when she was suffering such an agony of remorse that she had called on Miss Bartlett and confessed her sins. In Miss Bartlett's words, she said no one knew the terrible sins she had committed, and that it seemed as though she were nothing but evil, and that she sometimes said that she believed there was a personal devil, and that she was that devil. She also said at that time that I had no idea of the number of people she had been the means of putting out of the cause of Christian Science. I said I did not know something of what she was doing, but she said, quote, "You do not know how many I have caused to leave it," end quote. As near as I can remember, I asked her if she meant it was through mental influence this was done, and she said yes. She then said, I did not know what a wicked woman she was, and when she realized the enormity of her sins, her agony was almost unbearable. But fortunately, these times did not last long. She repeatedly spoke of Mrs. Eddy's great love and how she had borne with her for so long. As she was going out of the door, she said she did not think one would make such a confession as she had made to me for the fun of it. But confessing her sins seemed only to free Mrs. Woodbury to repeat the offenses. She had long coveted and endeavored to usurp Mrs. Eddy's position. Perhaps the leader had this in mind when she wrote in her dedicatory message to the church in Atlanta, Miscellany, page 187, quote, "Christian Science hath a place in its court, in which, like beds in hospitals, one man's head lies at another's feet," end quote. Another paragraph referred to her spiritual vision, or as she had named it to Judge Hanna, quote, "first sight," end quote. "In spirit, I enter your inner sanctuary, your heart's heart, the ponderous walls of your grand cathedral cannot prevent me from entering where the heart of a Southern has welcomed me." The message to Atlanta was only one of the numerous demands on the leader's time. A few others early in 1899 were a bylaw limiting the number of first members to 100, discontinuance of the international Bible lessons, the director's invitation to address the annual meeting, which she declined, an answer to the criticism of, quote, "a priest of the church," end quote, in the New York Commercial Advertiser, Miscellany, page 299, instructions to the directors to have Irving C. Tomlinson lecture in Boston Music Hall instead of the Mother Church because of the overcrowded conditions, and a poem, quote, "to the Sunday school children," end quote. Poems, page 43 of Augusta Stetson's church. The Atlanta church dedication was held on Easter Sunday, and Irving Tomlinson lectured at Boston Music Hall the following Wednesday evening. Mrs. Eddy had asked the directors to have members of the Boston churches attend this lecture, but some of them were turned away, for, according to the Sentinel of April 13th, quote, "When the lecture opened, every seat was occupied, and not less than 1,000 persons were standing in the aisles and by the doorways and in the corridors, filling the doorways. Several hundred went away, unable to find seats or standing room, such as would enable them to hear," end quote. The Sentinel also stated, "Another pleasant feature of the affair was the generous recognition accorded by the local press of Boston. The Boston Journal and Boston Traveler having published a full synopsis of the lecture." But it did not mention that the Boston Herald had been quite critical. This did not seem to perturb Mrs. Eddy, for she wrote Tomlinson on April 9th, "I had not read your lecture when I saw you last evening. Read it in bed after retiring. Laughed aloud at your, quote, unchristian beatitudes, end quote. Throughout it is self-evidently divine logic, clear cut as a diamond. Here is an instance of God's care. Had I seen or heard that lecture before you delivered it, believe I might have asked you to tone down its sharpest points. But I was led to deny myself this opportunity. Hence, the world has it, and probably not too soon. I can see why the Herald referred to it as it did. With love for my modern David, who meets the Goliaths." Some of the Goliaths the modern David had to meet were other students, either because they had not the leader's broad view and were pricked by the sharp points, or because they were perturbed by the stirring of the waters. Whatever the reason, when James Neal was at Pleasant View on April 10th, he told Mrs. Eddy that there were bad effects from Tomlinson's lecture. As a member of the publishing committee, he felt it had reversed some of their work. Immediately, the leader set about rectifying the situation and sent Mr. Neal back with an article for the Boston papers, Miscellany, page 338. The next day, she wrote again to Mr. Tomlinson, "Dearest Parson, Christ, the idea of love, is more to you than mortals ipsy dixit. I enclose in pen marks what must be left out. You can thrust in the sickle and reap the grain, but spare the oil, the balm of repentance, and the wine, the newly inspired love for Christian Science. The press was just returning to us, and this untimely present sharpness cuts some old Christians to the heart and turns away others. With changing the lecture a little and removing the marked passages, you can repeat it." The Boston scientists felt that the bylaw which appeared in the May Journal, Christ Jesus the Ensample, Manual, page 41, was pursuant to Tomlinson's lecture. A nota bene on her letter of April 11th to Reverend Tomlinson implies that care must be taken not to wound the innocent when courageously uncovering secret crimes of the wicked. Note well, When I speak of men or women afraid to meet the defense, I mean afraid to come out in open, noble, loving rebuke to certain secret crimes or immoralities, uncover them and show the remedy. By this, I do not mean mental or audible attacks, but kind, strong rebuke that will heal and not wound the good folks. Both Mrs. Eddy and all her workers in Boston were still struggling against Mrs. Woodbury's continued attacks. But the leader was also concerned with many other things in April, such as improving the binding of the Sentinel, improving the appearance of the Sentinel, advising the directors to hire a hall for annual meeting, directing the appointment of Judge Clarkson to the lecture board, etc. Evidently, the directors had found a florist, or someone had, for in April, Mrs. Eddy was sending flowers to Christian Science Hall each week. She mentioned both her florist and Joseph Mann, who was managing the grounds at Pleasant View, in the corrective letter she sent to Christian Science Hall on April 19th. Miscellany, page 151. I have the sweet satisfaction of sending to you weekly, by Mr. Mann, alias our best man, flowers that my skillful florist, Mr. Easton, has coaxed into loveliness, despite our winter snows. While all this was going on, Josephine Woodbury was putting the finishing touches on her most open and virulent attack to date. For some time, the Arena magazine had been favorably disposed toward occultism and antagonistic toward Christian Science, so it was a logical vehicle for the onslaught Mrs. Eddy had foreseen. The May issue proclaimed, quote, "Eddyism exposed," end quote, in an article entitled, quote, "Christian Science and Its Prophetess," end quote. Part one, quote, "The Facts of the Case," was written by the son of Julius Dresser and was the same old lie that Mrs. Eddy had gotten Christian Science from Mr. Quimby. Part two, quote, "The Book and the Woman," end quote, started from that premise and was an abusive attack from the pen of Josephine Curtis Woodbury. The scornful words of that poor, deluded woman described the workings of her own mind in her malicious attempt to depose the discoverer and founder of Christian Science. What she has really discovered are ways and means of perverting and prostituting the science of healing to her own ecclesiastical aggrandizement and to the moral and physical depravity of her dupes. What she has founded is a commercial system, monumental in its proportions, but already tottering to its fall. The wicked lies left the scientists in a state of shock, but they did not fall under Josephine's spell, as had so many in the past, including that astute scholar, James Henry Wigan, when her remarks were more subtle. Many reacted in righteous indignation, but few ever knew of Mrs. Eddy's response. Fortunately, Clara Shannon recalled these events of 1899 in her reminiscences and has recorded them for us. One morning, as our dear teacher sat writing letters, she called me and said, "To whom do you think I have just written?" From the look on her face, I said, "I suppose someone to whom no one else would write." And then she said, "It is to Josephine Woodbury." and I have invited her to come and see me. I have given her 2 days from which to select the time most convenient to her, and have asked her to telegraph and let me know the day. She read the letter through to me and told me to enclose a stamped telegraph form. I said, "Oh, Mother, how could you write to her when you know she is doing all she can to harm you, and not hiding it, but talking about it?" She said to me, "You must learn to love that woman." I said, "Do you love her?" "Yes, and I am trying to bless her. If you and I do not love her, who can or will?" To that letter, Mrs. Eddy received no reply. When the second day named came, before going out for her drive, she put on her special best dress and ordered the carriage to be at the door to take her for her drive an hour earlier than usual, in order to be home early before her guest arrived. Before leaving, our leader ordered another carriage to be sent to the station to meet her. Just as she was putting on her gloves, before entering her carriage, she called me from my writing and said, "Will you promise something?" I said, "Of course I will, if it is something I can do." She said, "If Mrs. Woodbury comes before I return, I want you to greet her kindly." I said, "Yes, Mother, I will." Then she said, lovingly, with a note of interrogation in her voice, "My answer was, I will try." Then she said, "Just heavenly?" I answered, "I will go upstairs and ask God to help me to do that, to show me how." Lastly, she repeated, "Now remember what I say, kindly, lovingly, just heavenly." I went to my room and prayed very earnestly to divine love to help me, for as it was right for her to feel that, it was right for me to manifest it. In a short time, I felt such a desire that she would come and willing to welcome her in the most heavenly way that I knew of, because I knew what a blessing there was awaiting her through an interview with our leader, and great good would result. Our leader returned from her drive an hour earlier than usual, and when she got out of her carriage, she said, "Has she come yet?" I said, "No, Mother." "Never mind," she said. "I will wait in the drawing room for her." In the meantime, the carriage had been sent a second and a third time to meet 3 trains in succession. The last time it was too late and too dark for her to have come, and our leader sat in the parlor waiting till then, after which she rose to return to her sitting room and said, "Oh, what a benediction of love she would have received. It would have saved and comforted her." I too felt sorry for her to have lost such an opportunity and a great blessing. I learned a lesson of love such as I have never forgotten. The mother reached out to comfort and save even those who reviled her and said all manner of evil against her falsely. But who would comfort the mother? On the 4th of May, she received a letter of loyalty and love from the first members of her church, stating that they would stand by her unflinchingly in this hour of trial when malice was striking such blows at her and her cause. The human loyalty and affection was appreciated, but it was not enough. The founder reached out to infinite love for comfort, and her own great love enabled her to see divine love in all God's universe, all around her, even in the minutiae of her daily life. That very morning, she had tossed a rubber band onto her dressing table as she turned to her washstand, and when she turned back, lo, there was a message from divine love. She called Calvin Fry to see how the rubber band had formed a perfect heart. To her, it was a sign from love, dissolving despair, and it inspired her to write, quote, Signs of the Heart, end quote. Poems, page 24. Come to me, joys of heaven, breathe in thy summer air, a balm, the long-lost leaven, dissolving death, despair. O little heart, to me thou art a sign that never can depart. O love divine, the heart of thine is all I need to comfort mine. When this poem was published, a short time later, a reader wrote, feeling a great sense of gratitude to our dear mother for her poems published in the journals, I wish to acknowledge the help received from reading the poem in the July number entitled, quote, Signs of the Heart, end quote. Error had been making claims of what I once thought heart trouble, which I had repeatedly denied. When the journal came to hand, I sat down at once and, of course, read the poem first. Before it was finished, the healing truth had dispelled the illusion.